From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Despite negotiations on an on-time budget deal, average New Yorkers have little access to the details. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the closed-door negotiations, and we'll take a look at the increase in oil and train traffic throughout the state. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Well, the budget deal was reached Friday in Albany. Average New Yorkers have had little access to the details of the important items that Governor Cuomo and lawmakers are discussing. That's because the long Albany tradition known as Three Men in a Room continues. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The only difference from the decades-long tradition of three men in a room budget negotiations is now there are four men in a room. The Senate is led by a coalition of Republicans and breakaway Democrats, and so has two co-leaders. Reporters, lobbyists, and advocates often wait for hours outside the door to Governor Cuomo's office, waiting for the legislative leaders to emerge.
Any developments?
There are big issues being discussed, including how to fund a brand new program to potentially provide all four-year-olds in the state with access to pre-kindergarten, and a large package of tax cuts that includes a complicated multi-step proposal from Governor Cuomo for a two-year property tax freeze. But when asked about details, the responses are often vague.
Everything's being discussed.
Senate GOP leader Dean Skelos and Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver give essentially the same answer when questioned about whether public campaign financing or the DREAM Act will be included in the budget.
Everything's being discussed.
We all draw no lines in the sand.
Everything's being discussed.
At other times, the responses are more cryptic. Speaker Silver was asked about how far apart the leaders in Cuomo are on a figure for funding pre-K.
We're not apart, per se. Everything's got to fit in with everything else. That's the real key.
Reporters sometimes try the point-blank approach to get information.
This progress that's been made, that you can talk about any kind of a deal or agreement or something that's off.
We'll have a budget in place before the end of the fiscal year.
All right, thank you.
The end of the fiscal year means Monday, March 31st. Blair Horner with the New York Public Interest Research Group has been a longtime observer of the state budget process. Horner says lawmakers are actually going backwards in recent years, and things have become even more opaque.
It was always sort of maybe Potemkin-like in terms of how open it really was. There were open leaders meetings where they would discuss the budget. There was a conference committee process where they would make some discussion of the process. That what I'm seeing now in the last few years has been a sort of a retrenchment toward less and less openness.
Governor Cuomo has readopted the closed-door method of deciding budgets, and he recently defended the practice.
Just because something is done behind closed doors doesn't mean the process isn't transparent, right? You can't do everything in public view always and have frank, candid, meaningful conversations.
Cuomo says some of the so-called open leaders meetings in the past were a sham.
It was a silly theater that accomplished virtually nothing.
The governor says he has released a detailed budget plan, and both houses of the legislature have passed budget resolutions, so the public should know where everyone stands. And he says the question and answer session with the media after the leaders' meetings helps provide transparency. Cuomo seldom appears after those meetings. The governor often touts his achievement of getting the budget passed on time for the 3 years that he's been in office, following decades of late budgets. Horner with NYPERG says perhaps the governor has made a decision that ultimately the ends justify the means.
despite what the governor says about closed doors being transparent, I guess it's only true if they're made of glass. In this particular case, though, yes. I mean, I think the governor has made a determination that it is better to have a flawed process that gets the budget done on time than anything else. And that from his perspective, that the public only reacts to budgets that are late or budgets that, you know, seriously impact services.
But he says the public should have more insight into decisions that involve their money. Horner says one way to help avoid the crunch that can lead to the closed-door meetings is to extend the budget deadline. He says most states don't have to settle their spending plans until July. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, Alan, as we speak on Thursday, we are hearing reports that we will have an on-time budget expected by midday Friday. Meanwhile, despite the negotiations on the on-time budget deal, most New Yorkers know little of what's in it because it's still three men, or should I say four men, in a room negotiating.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. In state politics, most people don't know beans about what goes on up in the Albany area. You say to people, who name your two state legislators, I wouldn't want to be around when those results were added up. So the idea that that people know what's in the budget is ludicrous. What's more, I would go as far as to say is the idea that most state legislators know what's in the budget may not be all that true. They know what's of interest to them, and very often in order to get them to go along, nobody knows what the total package looks like until this huge stack of bills is sitting on somebody's desk. And then they say, is my thing here? Yeah, okay, all right, I'm going along. So we do know that most people don't know much about the legislature, but they do know one thing. The budget was always late. And everybody said, oh, the budget is late. The news media, you know, would go along with it and say, the budget is late. Everybody would say, the budget is late. Then what the geniuses finally figured out, because remember, in the end, you're going to get just the same thing you were going to get in the beginning when it started to be late. So the geniuses who run the legislature figured out, oh, we'll be on time. And now everybody will say everything is all right. Well, everything isn't all right. The fact is, whatever is wrong with the budget, the kinds of deals that get made, the ideas that the lobbyists descend on the Capitol and say, I represent the boat lobby. Let's make sure that people who buy yachts get a better deal than they've been having tax-wise. That, for example, is one of the things that goes on when these negotiations are taking place. The lobbyists are attentive. The legislators who have items who are going to get money from individuals to run for office, you know, nobody ever says, I'll do this if you do this. But it's well understood, the wink and the nod, and that's how this place works. Frankly, it's disgusting. And the more that people don't pay attention and know what's going on, and the more the news media doesn't really do it right, the more that we can assume that this is not going to be working out in the people's interest.
Speaking of which, one of the people you spoke to this week was the Assembly Minority Leader, Brian Kolb. He acknowledged that he's not even involved in budget negotiations as a leader.
Well, no, there are three men in the room. We know that. The governor, the majority leader of the Senate, and his pal, the complicit Jeff Klein, who runs the independent caucus of Democrats who have combined with the Republicans to keep them in power, even though there are more Democrats elected, I think with the help of Governor Cuomo. In any case, the way that it works is that these guys go into a room, they make their decision, but the minorities in each house don't get anything, they don't get spit in the whole thing. It's not exactly the way a democracy might work, but hey, to the winners belong the spoils, and you just know that there's so few Republicans in the New York State Assembly now, mainly because of the way that they've, in the same way the Senate has organized itself and drawn its own districts thanks to the reapportionment efforts, that there are so few Republicans left in the Assembly that nobody needs them anymore.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. New York lawmakers approved a bill this week that would enter the state into the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, an agreement to award electoral votes to the presidential candidate who receives the majority of the popular vote. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Proponents of the National Popular Vote Initiative believe that the Electoral College, in place since the first days of the nation, is not the best way to elect a president. Supporters in the Empire State argue that changing the system to guarantee the presidency to the candidate who receives the most popular votes will raise New York's level on the national playing field, increasing its share of candidate visits and campaign ads. Capital Region Assemblyman Phil Steck reminds us that the 2000 presidential election was decided by the Supreme Court.
More Americans voted for Al Gore than voted for George Bush, and nonetheless, Bush, based on the decision of the Supreme Court, was elected president. Most people don't know that the Constitution commits to the states how the states will cast their electoral vote. And under this law, which other states would join in on, and others already have, the states having the most electoral votes, 270 required for election, those states would commit to vote for the presidential candidate who wins the popular vote, hence having a direct election of the president by the voters.
To date, 9 states and the District of Columbia have signed the compact, accounting for 136 electoral votes. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Joseph Grifo and Democratic Assemblyman Jeffrey Dinowitz, would add New York's 29 electoral votes. National Popular Vote President Barry Fadum.
Both houses of the New York legislature passed the National Popular Vote bill. What is very exciting to us is the huge margins in the Senate. The bill passed by a vote of 57-4, and in the House, the bill passed by a margin of 102-33. What is even more significant is that the bill enjoyed support across all lines.
The National Popular Vote Agreement goes into effect when 270 electoral votes are reached, enough to give the states that signed the compact a majority of the electoral votes. Assemblyman Steck notes that if the bill becomes law, New York would be the second largest state behind California, which has 55 electoral votes, to join the effort.
Then if states having another 100 electoral votes also agree to this, that it will mean the president will be elected by popular vote rather than the electoral college. And from a New York perspective, because of the way the electoral college is structured, New York's votes are devalued. So for example, the vote of an individual in Wyoming is 3.45 times more valuable than a vote in New York. So under the principle of one person, one vote, we should have an election for president that is based on who gets the most votes.
Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett of Hudson points out that the American democratic system was built on the ideal of equality and one person, one vote.
Our founding fathers, the architects of our republic, drafted the most profound document in our Constitution, but it wasn't perfect and times have changed. Sometimes it takes a step outside the given path to preserve that democracy. New Yorkers' votes have been diminished, and our voices need to be heard.
The bill now goes to Governor Andrew Cuomo's desk.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works heard testimony this week on transportation priorities and funding from state and local officials. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports on their assessment of our region's needs.
The current transportation law, known as MAP 21, or the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century Act, expires at the end of September. Chair Barbara Boxer of California convened the hearing to hear perspectives on investment priorities for the next service transportation authorization bill. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders noted that the rest of the world is spending significantly more to rebuild infrastructure than this country.
Bridges are crumbling, roads are in need of repair. So the bottom line to me is that we lose efficiency, we lose productivity. We have a crisis. We have waited too long to address it, but we have got to invest in that infrastructure
Massachusetts Democrat Edward Markey noted that the current transportation bill included $1.2 billion in federal highway funds for Massachusetts to modernize highways and bridges, and another $700 million in transit funding. Markey called that a good start, but not enough to deal with the magnitude of the problem.
Making investments in our infrastructure is essential to our economy. It puts construction workers on the clock in good-paying jobs. It creates the infrastructure necessary to efficiently move goods and people around our ever-changing and expanding economy. I know that when we rebuild our infrastructure, we rebuild our economy.
Meanwhile, New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker noted that 65,000 bridges across the U.S. are classified structurally deficient, and in New Jersey, 66% of major roads are in poor condition.
This enormous challenge demands that we as a nation invest more in our transportation infrastructure. Not only will a major investment improve safety and help businesses, but it will also create jobs and strengthen our entire economy. As we improve our infrastructure, businesses can move goods quicker and cheaper and reach more customers overseas. This is a critical economic competitiveness issue.
New York Senator Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand reported that the state has 115,000 public road miles and more than 17,000 bridges. 12.5% of the bridges are structurally deficient, and 27.1% are functionally obsolete. She says strong, sustainable funding for the Highway Trust Fund is crucial.
In New York, local governments own 45% of our state's federal highway miles and 51% of our bridges. These communities are stretched incredibly thin. This means that federal assistance is all the more critical.
Vermont Agency of Transportation Deputy Secretary Sue Minter served as the state's Irene Recovery Officer in the aftermath of that tropical storm. She told committee members that the transportation network is the backbone of the economy, and it is critical to fund a safe and reliable system.
The highway network is an integrated system that literally ties our nation together, and all states continue to need the federal government to play a leadership role in funding our system.
Minter added that is why all state DOTs and private transportation companies are concerned about the pending insolvency of the Transportation Trust Fund.
Just the prospect of the fund running low on cash by this July has already motivated many states to delay new capital projects. If the fund is not replenished soon, project delays will become cancellations, and a reduction in our transportation projects will have an immediate and negative economic impact.
Committee Chair California Democrat Barbara Boxer outlined a goal to mark up the bill by the end of April, including 6 years of funding and addressing the shortfall in the Highway Trust Fund.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A clear and present danger hiding in plain sight. That's how Cornell University's Susan Christofferson describes the oil train traffic through the state. A massive explosion caused by a runaway oil train in Quebec in July last year has raised awareness about the levels of flammable material being shipped by rail. The Innovation Trail's Jenna Flanagan spoke with the professor of city and regional planning about New York State's mobile oil problem.
Crude oil transported across New York is from the Bakken Shale Formation in North Dakota, the country's second largest oil-producing state.
Companies that are transporting oil are looking for flexibility
And if you're going to build oil pipelines, that's a very big investment, and it's a fixed investment. You have to put in the pipelines, and they're going to be there for a long time. They want a flexible form of transportation that is going to take the oil to the places they want to get it.
Christofferson says Bakken oil wells in North Dakota have a limited amount of product, so companies are eager to extract as much as possible and then sell it on the international market. Recent approvals by the State Department of Environmental Protections allow for almost 3 billion gallons of crude to be processed through the city of Albany.
We were focused on the shale gas activity as a drilling activity in place. And we weren't thinking about the transportation side of it. We weren't thinking about the whole supply chain. We were just thinking about the drilling.
Ironically, she says it was the obvious increase in the number of oil trains that caught the public's attention. People began to realize, she says, that crude oil transportation can present an imminent risk.
When you're shipping by rail, you're going to have accidents. That sort of goes with the territory. You're going to have industrial accidents. So partly what we have to keep in mind is that the oil and gas industry and the transportation of oil and gas is an industry that is dangerous and dirty and that has accidents.
The National Transportation Safety Board says the number of trains carrying crude oil has increased from almost 11,000 in 2009 to nearly 400,000 today. In 2013, a report from the Government Accountability Office noted that the Federal Railroad Administration only examines 1% of the country's railroad infrastructure. As a result, Governor Cuomo directed state agencies to review their emergency spill response plans and inspect rail lines. The State Department of Transportation announced that inspectors at rail yards in the Capital Region and Western New York yielded violation notices for defective equipment, broken rails, and noncompliant tank cars. Meanwhile, junior Democrat Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is pressing federal agencies like the EPA and the Coast Guard to implement their own contingency plans in case of spills. In Albany, I'm Jenna Flanagan for the Innovation Trail.
That about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1413. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.